this relationship between lattice models, which we think of as kind of abstract material types, and topological quantum field theories, which in this analogy we can think of as gotten by sewing manifolds out of these materials and measuring properties and getting invariance of the manifolds. So first two lectures was, as I said, just about the lattice systems, and these last two are going to be about topological quantum field theories. And I want to just set up that theory in such a way that I can try to connect these in a more concrete way in my lecture tomorrow. So today will be a little bit theoretical, and I'll just be reviewing a bunch of things that have been said in Kateri's lectures and Dan's. So there's going to be a lot of overlap, perhaps from a different point of view of this material with stuff in Dan's. So let me just remind you of the basic setup of topological quantum field theory. So there's this category, Bord N, an infinity N category. It's symmetric monoidal, and it has duals. So let me try to, you've heard about this in a couple times in other lectures. I'll just try to be a little bit quick. So I want to, when I'm writing this undecorated, I really mean Bord N, what's called Bord N framed. So an object is a K-morphism is a manifold of dimension K with corners, equipped with an isomorphism of the tangent bundle of M, bumped up to dimension N with RK. So it's N framed. So for example, an example of an object is a point, but I have to have equipped with that point an isomorphism of the tangent bundle of the point, which is the zero vector space, plus, zero plus Rn with Rn. So there's an element in On or GLn that's additional data. So there's a lot of one point objects in this category. There's one for every element in the general linear group. And the morphisms, as I'm not going to spell this out again, the morphisms are cobordisms, and among those, as well as diffeomorphisms, and that gives its higher structure. So the symmetric monoidal structure Symmetric monoidal structure is the disjoint union of manifolds, and I'm going to try to kind of avoid talking about the manifold side of things because this will collide with the coproduct in other categories. But this is not the coproduct in the that symbol is the symmetric monoidal structure in the category, and it's not the coproduct when the morphisms are cobordisms. So it can be confusing to call it that. And I think the duals has been talked about, so I think I won't spell that out, but that's this category. Now, there's a bunch of other variations in this, and some version of this, was that a question? I'm sorry? Oh, infinity N category. So it means that all the morphisms, it means there's morphisms at all levels, objects, one morphisms, two morphisms, etc., all the way up. But after the N morphisms, the N plus one morphisms and higher are all required to be invertible. Does that make sense? Y over n. So the manifolds are, I guess I kind of thought this had been covered in other lectures, I apologize, but an n-morphism is an n-manifold, and then you could imagine n plus one manifolds with some strange thing in their tangent structure, but k-morphism for k less than or equal to n is this, but there's also diffeomorphisms. So if you have an n plus one morphism, let me just say, so a closed n manifold defines some kind of an n morphism if it's got this kind of framing, and then a map between two of those has to be a diffeomorphism. Okay, so below that a map could be a cobordism, above that from n above as a diffeomorphism. So that's why we say infinity n. Okay. Okay. Now, I want to kind of step back and talk about these things really in the language of categories. So there's a bunch of variations on this. So there's board n and x. Suppose I have a space x. And in fact, let me give you a bigger generalization. So suppose X is a space X equipped with a map to BON. Let's call that zeta. Then we could look at this category board NX. whose objects are manifold, whose K-morphisms are K-manifolds equipped with a map to X. And an isomorphism of the tangent bundle of M bumped up to dimension N with the pullback of this vector bundle I call zeta. And so a simple example of this, and a common one, is, for example, X is BG, and the map zeta just goes to a point. The map is just constant. In that case, board in X is manifolds. It's the boardism category of manifolds with this stable framing. So N-framed manifolds equipped with a vector bundle plus a map into BG, a principal G bundle. So this G bundle is like a background field in this case, and this appeared a lot in Dan's talks as well. Now, there's some... So this is a description of a category, but this description has... There's another way I want to look at this. Okay, so so let me take the example where let's look at board in X, and let's suppose the map from X to BON is constant. Okay, again, it's just the constant map. So this is actually the colimit of the constant diagram in X of copies of board N. And that colimit takes place in symmetric monoidal categories. And I just to distinguish those, suppose instead of symmetric monoidal categories, I was working with abelian groups. So a toy example. To understand the difference is, suppose I have an abelian group A, and I have X is some, maybe a set or a space or something like that. Then the colimit over x of A in the category of sets is the set A cross X. If you just unpack the definitions in category theory, that's what this turns out to be. It's just the Cartesian product of A with the set X. But if I take the colimit in abelian groups, over X of A, I get A tensor, the free abelian group on X. So an object here is just a pair of elements, A, X, and an object here is a bunch of elements, summation AI times XI. It's like a divisor on X with labels in A. And I like to think of this as saying that somehow here the elements in A were sequestered from the elements of X. But when I took this colimit in abelian groups, the elements of A kind of get to embed in the elements of X. And this theorem, what I'm saying here about this being equal to this colimit, that's a theorem. I think probably we should just, this is probably a theorem due to Jacob Lurie. And in the invertible case, it's due to René Thome or something, but it's, or others. I'm sorry, I didn't think about references there. But this fact contains information in it. And I'm going to exploit this information in a minute. But because I took this colimit in symmetric monoidal categories, right, the manifolds get to participate in X, just in the same way these elements in this abelian group got to participate in X. And I want you to sort of the takeaway from this is there's content in this fact. When I gave you this definition of Bord NX, the manifolds came equipped with a background field in X. And that used strongly, I mean, this is just built as a colimit in Bord N, but it strongly uses the symmetric monoidal category part of it. Okay. There's a formula also due to Jacob Lurie for the more general ones when this isn't constant, but in the interest of time, I think I won't mention that just now. Now, the big theorem of Jacob's, and it's inspired, it's his reformulation of the Baez-Dolan cobordism hypothesis, is that this is the free one of these categories. Is the free infinity n category with duals on one object, any one of those points. And finally, let me go back to what's been the subject of many of the lectures here, is that a topological quantum field theory of dimension, a fully extended n-dimensional topological quantum field theory is a symmetric monoidal functor, or let me just say it's a functor from Bord N X for some X into some other category Cn, and this is this is of symmetric monoidal infinity n categories. And I didn't say with duals, because having duals is a property of the category. It's not structure. So this functor automatically, the image of this functor will automatically, everything in the image will automatically have duals, and this functor will automatically be compatible with the duality. So this has also come out in many of the lectures. And so I might as well assume, we might as well assume Cn has duals. Okay, so this is all well and good, but I want to point out a simple little trick. So I'm going to get, for the moment, I'll forget about the framing and some other remarkable aspects of this, but let's just look at Bord and BG into some category Cn. So that's a topological quantum field theory for manifolds with a background gauge field, and I'm looking at some quantum topological quantum field theory like that. And this is, of course, the colimit, as I just said, over n over BG in the category, in the appropriate category of Bord n. That's mapping to C. And that's the same, just formally, as maps from Bord n into the functor category from BG into C. Now, I didn't write this down, but it's really hard. If you want to tensor a space with an abelian group, that takes the space apart and it embeds the abelian group in the space. If you want to, that's the colimit. If you want to take the inverse limit, there's nothing to do. The set of functions from a space into an abelian group is an abelian group under pointwise multiplication, and that is the inverse limit of the functor. So this is nothing special. This is just functors, as I said, from BG into CN. And as it appeared in Dan's talk, that's the same thing as objects in CN with a group action. Okay. And since this is free on one generator, this is just saying to, if I have an object in C and I want to thought of as generating a topological quantum field theory, and I want to know what does it mean to extend it to manifolds with a G gauge field, that's just equivalent to giving the object the group action. And that correspondence has also appeared in many of the lectures. So one of the themes that I'm going to pick up is I'm going to try and take, this is just a beginning piece. I want to take any structure I see over here in manifolds and write it in terms of limits or colimits or whatever and push it over to this side and forget about manifolds because I'm interested in topological quantum field theories. So I saw Jack Morava do this in a talk once on chromatic homotopy theory, but you know there's this some universal category Cn for topological quantum field theories, and you can think of a topological quantum field theory as this complicated thing that every time you have a manifold, you calculate some object in a category you don't understand, and they have to obey all these constraints. Or you can just picture a topological quantum field theory as just one point right there inside this Cn, and that's kind of a lower processing load. In the next lecture talk about what it might take to go from information in Cn to a lattice model, and it will really clean things up. It'll help for what I want to say if we really push as many things as we can over to this category side and by using maneuvers like this. All the structures we'll have in Bordisms, we'll write them as some kind of limits or colimits, and then we'll push them over and think of them as structures in the category, and we'll do things over there. Okay, so that's one thing. So the next question, though, is, what is Cn? And I want to I want to talk about that, and I'll just say at the beginning, sort of my thinking about this probably starts more than 20 years ago and involves conversations with a lot of people, Dan Fried especially. I want to talk about a conjecture that came out of a paper of that is Singer and I wrote, and out of many conversations with Dan about the nature of C. And I've been going around for years talking about this conjecture, and it's been a great lesson for me in how math evolves, because the conjecture was sort of vague and kind of ambitious, and I've talked to many people, and it's, but by now that conjecture has taken on a pretty concrete form. And I want to kind of, my punchline today will be to tell you a little bit about the story of what's going on with that conjecture. There's two groups of people whose names I'll mention as I get closer to it. There's two groups of people who have both told me they're about to release papers proving some version of this. So for me, it's a very exciting state of affairs about this category C. And my purpose today is just to introduce some structure in this category, but I want to, my punchline is going to be a little bit the story of this conjecture. So it's a long list of people, so I'm going to just keep you in suspense about who that is for the moment. Okay, so one thing about CN is notice that board N So what do I even mean by CN? CN is supposed to be some universal target for n-dimensional topological quantum field theories. And one thing we know about it is that C0, so a zero-dimensional topological quantum field theory, that's just something that associates a number to a point, right? That's just the complex numbers regarded as a symmetric monoidal category under the tensor product with just, you know, it's just got an object for every complex number. There's no non-identity maps, and the tensor product is the symmetric monoidal structure. So the other thing that we know about these is that Cn is supposed to be maps in Cn plus 1 from the tensor unit to the tensor unit. So Cn, remember, it was a symmetric monoidal category, so it has a tensor unit. And because the maps in these Bordism categories work the way they do, the nth category is supposed to be just Hom of 1 from 1 to 1 in the n plus first category. So what we say often is that Cn plus 1 is a delooping of Cn, but we don't know, but that's just by analogy with algebraic topology, in which if I think of a space as a category, then Hom from a point to itself is the loop space. Okay, so, but the Cn is supposed to have, so what other structure is it supposed to have? I can think of really dumb deloopings of the complex numbers as a category. What other structures does it have? And we don't, as mathematicians, we can give it whatever structure we want, but we need the structure it has, we're supposed to get from the relationship with physics. And we've heard a lot about one structure that it's supposed to have, and let me try to, so these, in Dan's talks especially, which is these, we have to be able to form these finite path integrals over pi finite homotopy types. That was expressed as a structure of, when you like in terms of calculating things in terms of manifolds, and I want to express that right now just in terms of this category Cn. So let me just do a simple thing, right? Let's just think about the path integral where I have manifolds equipped with a background gauge field, and I have a functor from that to Cn. So some sort of field theory that depends on a choice of background gauge field. And then I'm supposed to be able to, out of that, so I call that F, I'm supposed to produce, let's call this map pi, I'm supposed to produce a new theory, I'll write it as pi lower star F, which doesn't depend on the gauge field, and this is supposed to be some sum over gauge fields. And that sum over gauge fields has a universal property, right? If I have a natural transformation, if I have another theory down here, a map from pi star F to some other theory G, that's supposed to be the same thing as if, as a map, a natural transformation from F to G composed with pi. So I could just regard G as a topological quantum field theory for manifolds with a gauge field that just ignores the gauge field. And now that I'm pointing up here, I realize this G and this G are the same letter. So let me call this like the general Mills G, and then we won't have to, I won't be worried about that. Okay, so I could, if I think of this, given this general Mills G, I could get a field theory depending on a background gauge field that doesn't care about, it just ignores the gauge field. And then I want to say that a natural transformation, whatever that means, from here to here, from this push forward to this, is the same as a transformation from here to here. All right, now back over in, now I can push both of these over into the category C. Right, if I wrote the top as a map from board N into Cn to the G, and the bottom as a map from Cn, then this functor pi is just, so that's just now an object in C to the G, and that functor, and composing with pi is like the diagonal inclusion here. And what we're saying is that this has a left adjoint. If you just translate this diagram into something here, this pi lower star, that's a left adjoint to this. So this pi lower star is the colimit over BG of some functor of some F. Okay, now why did I go through that? The big lesson here is that C, well, let me, I guess I don't need that giant picture over here when all I really care about is this point. So let me erase this giant picture and just say that that Cn should have all limits and co-limits over pi finite homotopy types. And furthermore, the reason for the finite in pi finite is that these limits and co-limits, well, it's embedded in the statement, right? Every object of C was dualizable, and so embedded in this statement is the assertion that these limits and co-limits are also supposed to be dualizable. That's why the finiteness is in there. In vector spaces, the dualizable vector spaces are finite dimensional. a finite sum of finite dimensional vector spaces is still finite dimensional and still dualizable, but the infinite sums aren't. So there's some content in this already. Cn, because of maneuvers we want to do in physics, Cn is supposed to have limits and co-limits over pi finite spaces. And this theory of these higher symmetries has an identical description in terms of Cn and these limits and co-limits. And I'll get to some pieces of that in my next talk. Okay, so that's one thing. But now, in particular, this gives me a hierarchy of properties of Cn. Okay, so in particular, Cn has an initial object. We'll call zero, and a terminal object. I'll call base point. One is the tensor unit. Now, here's a little exercise. Suppose Cn. So having this property, sort of finite limits. And everything being dualizable, that actually implies that the map from the initial object to the terminal object is an isomorphism. And I'll just give away the clue, although I'm taking something, the joy of figuring this out away from you, that one way of seeing this is to prove that zero tensor the initial object tensor anything is the initial object by writing a map out of it in terms of the dual. You also prove that the terminal object tensor something is the terminal object by writing something into it as in terms of the dual. And now you look at the initial object tensor the terminal object, and it's like the theorem with that, you know, two different units in a group are the same. But so anyway, that's left as an exercise. It's not a very difficult exercise, especially after that huge hint I just gave you. So anyway, this has initial object and terminal object are the same. And that means I can make a map from a finite coproduct of objects into the finite product of objects in C. And I can do that by, I just have to give you the factor. And this maps to, right, the finite coproduct, I can map that to x beta by sending, I can take the map that sends x alpha to the terminal object if alpha is not equal to beta. And the terminal object is the initial object. So when I coproduct that with beta, I just get x beta. I can take that map to be that component, and I get a map. And now, I apologize. I was trying to remember this. It's in my mind that this is also a consequence of all this dualizability, and I couldn't get the exercise figured out myself. So I'm just going to declare, for some reason, this is an isomorphism or an equivalence. It's somewhere in my mind that that's a consequence, just like this was a consequence of the dualizability. It's somewhere in my mind that this is also, but I couldn't get it. I couldn't work it out when I was preparing the talk, so I might be wrong about this. So finite coproducts are the same as finite products, and that implies that Cn is additive. I can add maps out of, or it's semi-additive. I can add maps between two objects form a monoid. I can add maps if I have two maps from x to y, then I can regard them as a single map into y cross y, but then y cross y is the coproduct of two copies of y. So I have the inverse of that, and then I can fold down to y and I can add maps. So whatever Cn is, it's additive. And this is the beginning of a whole hierarchy of fantastic properties that Jacob Lurie introduced called semi-additivity. And this is a beautiful notion, and so it's in a it's a so this notion appears in a paper of myself and Jacob Lurie called I think it's called the title kept changing, but I think it's called ambidexterity and chromatic homotopy. Theory, but I had things to do with the chromatic homotopy theory part, but the framework in which this the results are sort of formulated and proved is this notion of ambidexterity and higher semi-additivity, which was something that Jacob did himself. There's a beautiful paper of Yonatan Harpaz called. I think it's called Ambidexterity and the Universality of Finite Spans. So blah, 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 finite spans, blah, 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 will already give you a unique Google result if you're looking up that paper. And there's been tremendous progress on tremendous developments in ambidexterity and its and higher semi-additivity and its relationship to chromatic homotopy theory and other things in work of Tomer Schlank and let's see and Shachar Carmeli and Lior Yanowski and there's more there's sort of one of the proofs of this theorem I was talking about came out of this enterprise, and I'll mention the other names in a minute. But let me get on to saying what semi-additive is. So suppose I'm in an additive category. So we'll call a category zero semi-additive if the map from the initial object to the terminal object is an isomorphism. There's an elaborate recursive definition where there's a single property you demand every time, and you start with like negative one or something, but I have a hard time parsing that, so I'm just going to introduce what look like different things. So zero semi-additive is this, one semi-additive. Once you have this map, one semi-additive, once you have that map, you can map a finite coproduct to a finite product, and you ask that that's an isomorphism. So that's the maneuver we just did, and now you're in an additive category. So there's another level I'll talk about in terms of group actions for a minute. So suppose I have two semi-additive. So suppose I'm in an additive category. I'm in a one semi-additive category, and I have an object X, and it has an action of a finite group. Then I can make a map from the orbits of G, which is the colimit over this group action of X. Of this diagram, you think of this object as a functor from BG into the category, it's the colimit over BG of that functor to the inverse limit, which is the fixed points. And how do you get that? You just sum over G, but you don't divide by the order of G. That wouldn't make sense in an arbitrary category, so you send X to the sum over G and G of G times X. And I'm able to form that sum because of semi-additivity. I can add maps from X to itself, and so I can add these maps up over G. And two semi-additivity asks that this is an isomorphism. Now, a coproduct is a colimit over a finite set. This is a colimit over a space with one homotopy group, pi 1. And N semi-additivity has to do, by the time you get to it, N semi-additivity implies, there's many, many more aspects to this, but this implies that the colimit over F of X to the limit over F of X, so there's is an isomorphism. And F is an N truncate, an N minus one truncated, or it's a finite, it's a space where pi I of F is zero for I greater than or equal to N, and otherwise it's finite. So this space has pi 1 is finite, and I'm 2 semi-additive. And the recursion that happens here is, like, once I know this, then I can formulate. If I know it's n minus 1 semi-additive, then I can formulate, I can form this map and then ask that it be an isomorphism. So back here, right, we used, once I had this map, once I knew that was an isomorphism, I could form this map and ask that it be an isomorphism. Once I have that map, I can form this map and ask that it be an isomorphism. And it goes on and on and on. And another thing about that, notice the language was entirely in terms of I'm given a map and I ask for a condition on that map. It's a condition on a category. It's not added structure. So the condition is that it be, it's like having duals. The condition is that it's M semi-additive. Okay, so, I don't know how time, it's like there's this twin paradox thing that happens when you're lecturing. I'm not getting up to my main point quickly enough. So what do we know about these Cs? We know that Cn, C0 is the complex numbers. Cn is n semi-additive. Or that's supposed to be m semi-additive for all m. And that's, we're not making that up. We expect it to have that property in order to be able to do these finite path integrals. So that comes from a need articulated in the world of physics. It's M semi-additive for all M. And then we also know that this thing about the loop space, that Cn is maps in Cn plus 1 from 1 to 1. So let's try to figure out what C1 is. Okay, well, so C1 is an additive category. And suppose I have an object, let me call it V in C1, then maps from 1 into V, that's got an additive structure, right? That's an abelian group, or at least an abelian monoid. But it's also a module over C1 of 1, 1, which is the complex numbers. So this is a complex vector space. So I get a functor from C1 to complex vector spaces by sending an object V to maps from 1 into V. There's also a functor back that sends Cn into the coproduct of n copies of 1. And so it's natural to guess that this map be an equivalence. It's a natural guess. You might think, well, C1 should just be complex vector spaces. So that gets me into this conjecture that emerged more than 20 years ago and evolved over many discussions and many kind of corrections and things like that. So I'm going to push something mathematical, but that's also derived from a physical principle. So these categories, so you're supposed to think of CN as being like a ring. We decided it had to have an additive structure if we're going to do path integrals. It was a symmetric monoidal category. Because it has duals, the co-product distributes over the tensor product distributes over the co-product. And so think of it as like a ring, and it has inside it a group of units. So this will be the groupoid. So this is the category. This has objects, the invertible objects of C, the set of all x in C such that there exists a y with x tensor y equal to 1. And I only want invertible maps. So I could imagine lots of maps between these, but I'm restricting to invertible maps. So this CN cross, it's really a space. It's just a category where all the maps are invertible is just a space. And let's do a quick example. If I take vect cross, the objects, there's only one object. It's the one-dimensional vector space. And the maps from the object to itself, well, I'm only looking at invertible maps, so that's the units in C. So this space is just B C cross. Now, the other property, and I want to compare that property to this relation, this Cn plus 1, Cn being maps in Cn plus 1 from 1 to 1, this implies that the units in Cn is actually topologically is the loop space of the units in Cn plus 1. So this collection of Cns, this forms an infinite loop space, or a spectrum in the sense of algebraic topology. And what do we know about that spectrum? So let me call that spectrum I. Okay, so we know that pi zero of I is pi zero of C zero cross, which is the unit complex numbers. And we don't know anything else about that. But there's a cool theorem that this is a universal property of a spectrum. So there's a theorem, it's due to Ed Brown and his collaborator, I've forgotten his first name, Kamenetz. And it's based on Brown representability theorem, but it says there exists a spectrum, which I'll call IC cross, characterized by the property that homotopy classes of maps from any other spectrum into IC cross is HOM of pi zero E into C cross. So if you know about homotopy theory, this is just C cross is an injective abelian group, so this is a cohomology. This sends cofibrations to long exact sequences, and so this is a cohomology theory, and by Brown representable, it's representable. So this IC cross is the representing object for this, and so whatever I is, whatever the spectrum I is, there's a map from I to IC cross that's an ISO on pi zero. So the conjecture that kind of was in our minds, certainly, I mean, Dan was a big part of the paper Singer and I wrote in the early 2000s, and this idea, at that point we were really only thinking about invertible theories, but this conjecture was certainly in our minds, and the conjecture is that this should be an isomorphism. And Dan, in our paper, in Dan, the paper Dan and I wrote on reflection positivity, that's stated as a conjecture. And this is a conjecture I went around giving lots of talks about. I talked about when I was giving lectures on the reflection positivity paper, reflection positivity in invertible topological phases, I stated this conjecture. And a lot of times people would have this kind of who cares attitude. I often tried to justify this conjecture, and I'll describe the justification in a minute. But the first person that really had something interesting to say about this was Theo. And I was proposing to look for a similar universal property of CN itself that was not that implied this. And this was probably 8 years ago, and Theo pointed out that there was a sort of emerging notion of algebraic or separable closure of CN, and that was probably the property we were looking for. So what I want to do, I know there's only 45 minutes left, so in the remaining, oh, even Matt didn't get a chuckle. That's always bad. I want to, I do want to finish my story, so I apologize. I'm going to go a little bit over today, but not a lot over. So in the meantime, this notion of algebraic closure, it kind of appeared. Tomer and a bunch of his collaborators sort of. There's a theorem of Jacob's in mind in chromatic homotopy theory that proves an analog of this. And Tomer, but it's very computational. Tomer and his group found a conceptual proof of that, and at the same time, Theo Johnson-Fried and David Reuters. I'm sorry. Oh shoot. Just a sec. I have these names all here. David Reuter. So they together have what you might call a proof of this, and an understanding, and an understanding, a proposition for what else CN plus one should be. And in the chromatic homotopy world, there was a paper of Robert Birkeland. Well, maybe I'll leave off the. There's a lot of names here. Robert Birkeland, who was a graduate student, Alan Yuan, or Tomer, and Alan Yuan gave this new proof of this theorem of Jacob's in mind, and then Tomer, the sort of gang of three here, of Shachar, Tomer. And Ian Unowski, or Lior Unowski. So these are other groups, but these, so I'm told by two of these groups of people that there's a paper that is about to appear that will, they converged on the same or very similar results. And I want to just take a little bit of time. I find this personally very exciting. This has been a long period of adjusting this question. And anyway, I want to explain the statement of that theorem and what we think is going on. But before I do that, I want to go back to something, the process here. I mean, we're trying to be stingy about what this category CN is, and we started with some properties it should have that physics told us it needs to have. And we really don't want to let anything else into the game that's not there in physics. So there was meant to be a physical justification for this. And that is, so in an invertible field theory is a map from a Bordism spectrum into this I, whatever it is. And this composition just remembers the partition function of the theory. So this was, so what Dan and I think in separately when we were giving talks often tried to justify this by saying that this has to do with the idea that the partition function determines the theory. And that's great. Another way of saying it is that whatever I is, it maps to this. And if physics is going to tell us these aren't the same, then physics, it's the job of physics to produce the symmetries that are acting here that fix this. And I haven't heard of any of these. That doesn't mean they're not there. And every time I say that, physicists who know a lot more tell me that I haven't heard of very much. But anyway, there's something at stake in physics. I mean, this conjecture actually makes an assertion about nature. And I'll try to keep this to just something short, 5, maybe 10 minutes. What I want to do is explain how this statement evolved and what it is we think that CN is, and what this is actually saying, that what this is asking of nature, if you want. Okay, so I want to go back. Let's go back to Vect, right? So we had this functor from C1 to Vect, and we had a functor back. This functor was symmetric monoidal. This one didn't need to be. And we wondered if C1 was Vect. And so if we look at Vect cross, we decided that that's B C star. And this, in this other language, that's supposed to be, if this is the same, this is supposed to be loop infinity of the suspension of I C star. So this M means I'm supposed to shift this before I take the zero space. And so pi zero of this is pi zero of the suspension of I C cross, which is pi negative one of I C cross. So that's maps from the negative one sphere into I C cross, which is Hom of pi zero of S negative one into C cross. And that group is Z mod two. And so this group is Z mod two. So this is not the same as this. And so that means if this was just vector spaces, then this conjecture wouldn't be right. And so what does this Z2 mean? And what does it allow us to do if we just use the legal methods that physics has given us? All right, so this is gonna look a little bit fancy, but how do I think of that Z2? That Z2 is that Z2 corresponds, if you want. So it's an infinite loop map from Z2 into B of Vect cross, right? There was an element in pi zero that wasn't there, and anyway, it corresponds to something in pi negative one, or if you want, it's an infinite loop map like that. So it's a map. I knew I was gonna get tired and get stuck when I was getting these numbers together. So let me Wait, I think I can just say it. So I'm supposed to wind up with a map from VZ2 into K C cross 3, I think. Yeah, I'm supposed to wind up with a map like that. And so I think that's right. So vect cross is K C cross 1. B vect cross is K C cross 2. So this is an infinite loop map, so I can at least deloop it once and get this. And I want to think of that. Let's just, I'm going to do this a little faster than I had meant to, but let's think of that as a group. So I can pull this back and write it as a vibration sequence. And then I can loop it once more. So I get K C cross 2 to some loops on E to some Z mod 2. And this is an extension. It's a commutative group extension. It's an extension of infinite loop spaces. And this is K C cross 1, which is lines. So there's a... I'm not saying this very well, I'm sorry, but I think I thought I was going to have more time here. This gives me a functor from BZ mod 2. This gives me a functor from BZ mod 2 into, I should have just stuck here. It gives me a diagram in the category of C to the two category of C linear categories. And what you do, and it's infinitely commutative. You take the colimit of this. And that gives me a C linear category. And because this was an infinite loop map, that's a symmetric monoidal C linear category. And what that works out to be is super vector spaces. So if I take super vector spaces and I take its units, I do get this. And if I didn't do that, I can take a colimit over a finite homotopy type and build supervector spaces. And now the question is, should we instead of vectors, does that mean that when we're doing, we should have done physics with supervector spaces instead of just ordinary vector spaces? And we know the answer to that is yes. So one version of this, does the partition function give you determine the theory, it implies, if you follow all the rules we've been following, that you're going to need to talk about supersymmetry. And because I'm so short on time, I'm just going to tell you that this leads to a notion of and this was the way Theo kind of put it to me a long time ago. This leads to a notion of CN being separably or algebraically closed. And there's a rough procedure that you start with Cn, then you form the n plus 1 category of dualizable Cn modules. So we started with the complex numbers. We looked at dualizable Cn vector spaces. These are automatically, if this was M semi-additive, this is automatically M semi-additive. And that's a, and then you form its algebraic or separable closure. And that gives you Cn plus one. So I really, the this is one thing to say at this level. There's a lot of details that go into this, but it's a, it's, I've been schooled in it both by Theo and by Tomer and Robert, and anyway, it's a beautiful, I find it a very beautiful construction, and when you do this, the units in C, the conjecture holds that that is loop infinity sigma n plus 1 I C cross. So there's a, that's a, it's a formal argument based on this argument that I kind of did in a funny way here. So I wanted to advertise this, that we have a good, we have a good idea now of what this universal category should be and what properties it has to have. But there was one thing that we did that did not come, wasn't a directive from physics, and that was passing to this separable closure. And that question is the same. It's the same as this one about, does the partition function determine the theory? But let me just go through these small values of n and just think about why do we know this is the right thing to do? So for n equals zero, the first thing is that we use the complex numbers. And so that's the question of why is the wave function a complex valued? And there's, you know, I don't know that there's a great explanation for that. It's convenient, it explains interference. There's, if you Google that, you'll find all kinds of groups of people that postulate it didn't need to be, but the sort of general wisdom is that that's what we want. We want an algebraically closed field or the complex numbers when n equals zero. When n equals one, we're looking at super vector spaces. And why do we look at those? Well, that's because we needed the Pauli exclusion principle to explain things about the energies in atoms. So this came from the existence of fermions, and the need to use super vector spaces came from an experimental observation. And it just strikes me, there's a series of questions here. They all come from one math question, and the explanation in physics that I know seem very different. Like I said, this has to do with the existence of fermions. This has something to do with interference. I don't know how to think about the state of affairs, but it would be, in a way, maybe this is something about mathematics. Mathematics making a prediction about physics, because we have a prediction about what these categories should be, or we had a prediction even in the invertible case. But it's an interesting puzzle. So I've gone over time. I'm going to stop. I'll just repeat them. My goal today was just to introduce some things about this target category. And in the next lecture, I'm going to talk about boundary conditions and all these kind of things Dan talked about in the language of this target category. But I really wanted to advertise this, I think, tremendous development recently by these groups of people that give us a pretty good idea of what this category should be. All right, I'm going to stop now.
Are there questions for Mike?
Oh, there's a question.
All right. Could you talk about the n equals to 2 case?
I think what works if n equals 2, although I'm going to need Theo to back me up on this. So when n equals 2, I think it's sort of the Morita category of superalgebras. That at least has the correct units, and I think that's the correct category. I mean, superalgebras, an algebra is really a linear category with a choice of object in that category. So I don't like to say algebras, but so superalgebras would be some, it's essentially categories suitably, it's modules over supervector spaces. And if you can choose a generator, it becomes a superalgebra. So it's this Morita category. And then, and there's the next one Theo will have to tell you about, but that's, that one's, I think even at our meeting, at the meeting of this collaboration last fall, there was a lot of discussion about what could be going, because it looked like there were things going on here that seemed to contradict that conjecture about the invertible objects. But anyway, Theo's really the expert on that. So, but
of a shout out to other people in the collaboration, which is that Claudia and Dan and Constantine have a three category that they've studied, which I believe is the next level.
Yeah.
And I think that is the right thing. So you should, there's.
So one thing, yeah, I didn't get to, there's also a thought about what the Galois group of CN should be, but that's a, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have mentioned that. I mean, I was going to say something about it. If there's time in tomorrow's lecture, I'll say something about it, but I suspect there won't be. But there's another, there's a lot of, there's a, yeah, anyway, thank you.
Yeah, I might expect that go, if I go down a bit, then physically there is a, something about the statistic of the strings instead of the particle. Anything like that?
I didn't quite get that. Were you saying that something about statistics of strings would?
Yeah, it's not probably not n equals two.
There's also a question in the chat from Yuven Wang asking if you could comment about the connection of this lecture to the other two lectures, in particular matrix product states.
I will comment, I will connect this lecture to the other lectures in my next lecture, but
you could draw the graph again.
Yeah, if I have a superalgebra, I mean, yeah, I could just draw, if I have a superalgebra, I can make a 1+1-dimensional model of local projection Hamiltonians. Let's just take them all to be A. Anyway, I could do, if I had a superalgebra and some chain of bimodules or something, I could make a local projection Hamiltonian model like this. If A is Clifford 1, this is Kataya's Majorana chain. And anyway, that's, I don't know if that answers your question. I mean, in the next lecture, we're just gonna realize that this is just an elaborate list of boundary conditions. Well, this isn't very elaborate, but that there's some elaborate list of boundary conditions you can hope to put on the topological field theory to make a lattice system. But I will talk about that in the next lecture. Yeah. Michaela, I've seen you just with that before.
So semi-additivity only saw the one category struck, the infinity one, underlying infinity one category in CN. Is there like some sort of higher categorical, better version of it?
I mean, yeah, I think I'm not sure. When we're taking these path integrals over finite homotopy types, we're thinking about the, yeah, I don't know. I mean, is that what condensations are supposed
to
be doing?
I don't mean that those should be the right thing necessarily. Like there could be some other sort of the more immediate, more obvious, higher category version of them that feels more like semi-additivity.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
So there was also this other spectrum that occurred very often in your paper with Dan, which is the Anderson dual of the sphere.
Yeah. And how does that fit in?
Yeah, let's just ask that. Yeah.
I mean, it's just, it depends if you want to give C star. So the sequence C. Or let's say e to the 2 pi I, whatever, right? That sequence gives me a vibration sequence that goes from, so these are both injective, so that's I C star, something I might call I C, and then we call the fiber I Z. That's the Anderson dual, and it, I mean, that's played many roles in things. And it just depends on if you want to regard the complex numbers as contractible, and so that this has a topology that's got the topology of the circle, then you want to be working with this IZ, not IC star. And roughly speaking, a map from X into IZ, that's supposed to be like, that's like R Hom. Well, I mean, there's a map from that to Hom pi zero x into z with kernel x pi negative one of x into z, or it's R Hom into z instead of Hom. But I think for sometimes this feels more relevant. It was in some of the things we do, and sometimes this. And for this, the connection to the actual, I'm trying to connect to the simplest kinds of lattice models, and I think they're going to be the ones. I think it's easier to assume C is discrete and the systems can't move. I mean, one of the things that often comes up is like the Kataev E8 phase, it's classified by a map into this IZ, which doesn't really lift to IC star. And that's connected to not having topological boundary conditions and things. So I don't know, this was a natural thing to do when Dan and I wrote our paper, because for some purposes you want to think of the topology on the complex numbers. And so if you want to do that, you should mod that out and make this. But for what I'm thinking about for this series of lectures, this is all I want to focus on. I don't know if that answered your question, but that's the, yeah.
If there are no other questions or comments on the lecture, we can thank Mike again.